Coin Talk back here at home in the crypto cave. To my left, Jay Kang coming on shortly. We're going to talk a little China blockchain news. We're going to talk, I feel like I should make these introductions more hyperbolic. We're going to talk about the securities regulation that could destroy Ethereum. And we are also going to do a deep dive into ZRX, one of the coins that people are talking about could be the next addition to Coinbase. All that coming up on Coin Talk. First, I want to tell you a little bit about our partner Medium and their crypto landing page at me.dm/crypto. It's got tons of great crypto writing. If you like it, maybe support the writers by becoming a member. $5 a month, $60 a year, something like that. It's not that much money and it supports great writing. Okay, here's the show.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, April 25th at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,936.
Welcome to Coin Talk. Jay Kang back in the crypto cave.
I feel like I've returned home.
There's way more pegboard than there was last time you were here, right?
Yeah, and there's also some sort of acoustic ceiling things going on, I think, that you just put in.
Those have always been there.
Oh, well, they seem a bit askance, Aaron.
They're not straight at this juncture.
Did you have like a small earthquake in here or something like that?
No, I think it was just rustling around behind the wire. So there. I had a little flood. That's probably what everything had knocked askance. One thing I actually was curious to get your take on, I was reading Brian Selkis's email newsletter this morning, and he was commenting on, now that we're seeing a little light at the end of the tunnel, a little bounce back, like looking back on this big downturn that happened, what coins held their value the best against Bitcoin? This is something we've talked about. Like,
yeah,
you know, altcoins can be a lot of fun while you're playing with them, but you're going to take a hit during a dip. And he crunched what were the five coins that held their value the best. A couple of them I'm not familiar with. Bitom, Zilliqa, ZXL, EOS, BNB, Binance Coin, and OmisGo, OMG, your old favorite. And the thing that he noticed amongst these coins that had held their value the best is that they're all less than a year old.
OMG is less than a year old?
I guess so. I didn't know that either. But what do you think about that? As we look at these other projects over time, do you think that there's going to be a recency bias where stuff that's newer, people are more likely to hold on to during a downturn?
I think I would ask a question before that, which is like, what are we expecting to figure out? Like, what do we think that this holding of value tells us, right?
Right. That's a good question. I mean, I would think it would be a signal of long-term viability of the project that people are willing to hodl its tokens through a dark winter.
Yeah, I guess I would just say that like a five then would be too small of a sample for me to think that that was viable, because something like BNB, which is the sort of utility token that the Binance exchange puts out, there are all sorts of reasons why it wouldn't lose its value. It could be because people are actually still using it to trade during down periods of time. It could be that like CZ, who is the guy who's the head of Binance, it could be that he has all of them and just held them throughout it. And I'm not saying any of this is true, obviously. But I think that I would need a slightly larger sample size to figure out if there is any sort of correlation or any sort of story that we could tell out of it.
I like your take there. I actually think there is an explanation in terms of BNB, which is that I'm not positive about this, but I think that Binance has started auto-converting what is referred to as dust, the like little bits of coins that are left over in transactions, the infinitesimal decimal points, into their native token BNB automatically, so as not to leave you, which I actually appreciate, because I've got my Bittrex account is chock full of weird scraps that are less than a coin. But that would kind of explain like an inflow of automated interest in BNB if every single transaction's generating a little BNB for people.
The subtext to all this seems to be the coins in which people seem to have a lot of faith in both the technology and the longevity of the projects, did they do badly? Like, so something like Monero, which we talk about here a lot, Zcash, Ethereum. I guess Ethereum probably, he wasn't including that, was he?
I don't know.
Ethereum got wrecked anyway.
Yeah, Ethereum got pretty wrecked. I don't know, like, I'm not sure exactly what his, like, pegs were, but, like, bottom Ethereum was wrecked to Bitcoin.
Yeah.
Like you were, if you were holding all Ethereum, you did worse than someone who was holding all Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think significantly worse. So I guess that would be the underlying question, right? Like, was there institutional and investor faith in these long-term projects and in these big projects that allowed them to weather this sort of storm better than something that felt completely like vaporware?
Yeah.
And that was just being ridden for like pumps and dumps. And he seems to have shown, at least in limited form, this is not, you know, that maybe that wasn't true.
Yeah, I mean, I agree the sample size is low, and it does seem anecdotally like Monero and Zcash and a lot of these privacy coins that have more of a real world utility right now did hold their value pretty well compared to like alts as a whole. But I kind of agree with you. Like someone was saying that those privacy coins have done well recently because of like some porn thing accepting them or something.
Pornhub.
Like, what's that?
Pornhub.
Pornhub accepting them. So as usual, I think there's like maybe too many factors to read a lot of these things clearly.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting idea in its own right, that like there are so many forces acting on these coins that to try to draw any sort of a singular narrative is to draw a false narrative around it.
Yeah.
But I would love, I wish I could just sort, like, 'cause a lot of these projects, I don't know how old they are. I love this, that this was more like Saved by the Bell classes, you know, where it was like the first year of alts, the second year of alts, like next generation, you know, because I do think
summer with Stacey Caressi.
Yeah. I think that they, I do think the different waves of this stuff are pretty different than each other, and how you would evaluate a project that's like 1 year old versus the project that's 2 or 3 year old would be different in your expectations of how far along they would be. And, you know, I wish as an investor, I had more of a thesis about the age of the projects that I'm buying into.
Yeah, I have no idea either. And honestly, there is part of me that where when I think about a project that's very old and I research it and there's not much new about it, I sometimes wonder if it still exists or not. So I wanted to talk to you about something, which is that this is a story out of China that I actually found interesting in terms of people always asking this, I guess this infinite question of about what is the blockchain? Does it actually have any applications? And in China, it seems like, and look, this heavily caveated story, I don't know if it's real.
Yes.
It was on Yahoo, so you can take that for what it is.
Probably not real, though.
But in China, there was a student who was looking into sexual harassment at a university 20 years ago as part of sort of this extension of Me Too, I would say. And like there's a documentary about this recently called Red Sparrow, which was a very similar narrative in which somebody was looking back in the past. Did you see that?
Wait, isn't Red Sparrow that most recent, like, Russian action thriller? Or is this, there are two movies called Red Sparrow?
I think there's two movies called Red Sparrow. Okay. This is like a Chinese film student who made it. It was very good. And it might not be called Red Sparrow, so whatever. Like, we'll figure it out.
Look,
but it's
as we've said, none of this is investment advice. I got wrong how the blockchain was created. Jay has totally misidentified the film Red Sparrow, which I'm pretty sure
has Jennifer Lawrence
is
in it,
a
right?
Jennifer Lawrence action vehicle that was recently.
It's Red something. All right, so
I was wondering how you're going to tie the Jennifer Lawrence vehicle Red Sparrow into Chinese blockchain censorship, and I was ready for some verbal fireworks.
I looked it up. It's Hooligan Sparrow.
Hooligan Sparrow.
Hooligan Sparrow.
That's a great title.
It is a good. A good title. It's a good documentary. It's a very similar narrative in which a woman is trying to investigate something that has happened, and she comes up against all sorts of resistance and censorship. So,
okay, Hooligan Sparrow is similar to this blockchain
story.
This
young student at Peking University is trying to figure out what happened 20 years ago.
Yep.
All of her questions are rebuffed, and that she feels somewhat at danger, but she still writes an open letter to Peking University. And she puts it on WeChat and it goes viral, right? And she's like, why are you not answering these questions? A lot of the messaging apps in China start taking this letter down, right? And so people in China, to get around it, do things like they'll like embed the text in an image and then send that around so that it doesn't quite match up with the image so that it stays there. But that starts getting taken down. Then someone has the idea to put it on the Ethereum blockchain. And so at that point, it can't be taken down. And so the Yahoo article, which is somewhat noncommittal about it because, you know, it's not an advocacy journal, is saying that, you know, like, this is actually an interesting application of the blockchain here. What do you think about this?
I think my mind goes very quickly to the dark side when I think about this stuff. I actually just was talking to Charlie Warzel, who we've had on this show. And with all of the things that are happening to the big American tech companies, which themselves were originally identified with allowing for the kind of speech that we're talking about, that they were forums where anyone, not just someone who had a magazine or a printing press or whatever, could get their message out, could freely express themselves. And now a lot of those systems have been co-opted.
Sure.
And so the blockchain does feel like a step forward along that progression. But I just immediately jumped to inerasable text. It's like the force. There's like the light and the dark side of it. I can't imagine that people are not going to find some pretty like dark uses for the same thing.
Yeah.
Should I not let like the bad possibilities ruin the good possibilities for me?
Like this is something in our world, right? Like not our world, because you refuse to acknowledge that you're a journalist in any sort of way, but we've had a lot of controversies all the way up to Joyann Reid right now, which if you don't know, she had a blog a while back and there's a homophobic post. And she is saying now that she didn't make them and that
she said she got like hacked or something.
Yeah, that some hacker went back and timestamped and inserted those blogs into her.
I'm gonna set an overall rule for humanity. If you got hacked and you're gonna claim in the future that you got hacked, you have like, it's like the 30-second rule for food dropping on the floor. You gotta call out, I got hacked. Like
immediately.
It's like a bank shot. You can't be like, I called bank like 3 days later.
Yeah, there's no one who got hacked. Like my favorite example of this is the guy on Villanova in the national championship who hit all those shots. I forget his name, but like he was the MVP of the finals.
Yeah.
And he had all these problematic tweets from when he was 16 or 17 years old, which is understandable. 17-year-olds say stupid shit.
Absolutely.
But Villanova immediately, right when they were asked, were like, he was hacked. And then you're like, he was not hacked, you know, unless some hacker went back 4 years ago and changed all of his tweets. It's actually functionally impossible for him to be hacked. And then they scrubbed the he was hacked line. But they tried to follow your rule of 30 seconds, but went the wrong way because they just lied about it. But I agree with you.
Those things make no sense also because it's like you got hacked and then you got back control of your account, but you left the homophobic tweets that were like there from the hacking.
Yeah. So the Joyann Reid thing is interesting because it's sort of both sides of it, right?
Yeah.
If she had published all those on the blockchain, then no one could hack it because she would always have a record of what she had said at the time.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it also sort of shows how if you do say something in the past that can be misconstrued or excerpted or however and never disappears, that also can be bad, you know?
Yeah. I feel like you should be able to like discount some things you said when you were 16 or 17.
Yeah, and I mean, like, there's some people who, because of that, myself included, who put on programs to delete all your tweets after a few days. There's a great argument to be had, and I obviously am one side of it, and some people say, well, as a journalist, you should have all these things be public record forever. I'm like, I only tweet about the NBA, you know?
Yeah.
Like, and so I don't think it's really that big of a deal. But, you know, like, it really is sort of scary to think that if you are 17 years old right now or 16 years old and you're in, like, a, you know, like, the type of thing that young people do, which is try and say the most horrible thing to your friends.
You're 17, you're publishing willy-nilly on the Ethereum blockchain. You don't know where this could lead.
Exactly. Like, you and your friends are making, like, horrible racist and Holocaust jokes to one another.
Yeah.
And then it's there forever. Like, it seems like you shouldn't do those things, but I'm sorry, that's just like a part of young behavior. And if a system gets normalized in which everybody can see it and it is forever, that might be bad.
Okay, I'm going to play the other side here and say, what this woman has done in China is not publish her entire life history to the Ethereum blockchain. She's taken a particular document that was already subject to state censorship or unofficial state censorship and said, this is important. I want this to persist.
Yes.
Do you think that like having some sort of a more subjective approach to it, that if we're not saving everything, but we're like very specifically saving some things, that could have a utility?
Yes. And that's where I feel like that, you know, people should strive to go with this type of project. So we had Maria Bastillos on before with Popula. And she said that they were going to publish all their articles to the notes section of the Ethereum blockchain and that it would be immutable.
Yep.
And that, you know, nobody could take it down.
Yep.
Now, I would say that projects like that make sense to me. And it is a take it or leave it type of thing. There's no totality where every tweet that you and I put out or every text that I send to you needs to be on these blockchains, right? Like, it can be a specific tool that's used in these sorts of instances. And I find it very hard for anyone who would argue that it's not good in these cases. Like, this, if this China story is true, you know, that's great. You know, it's a way to get around censorship. It's a way to raise awareness about what might have happened 20 years ago. And it is a way to get around, like, what is, you know, people in China are very afraid right now because of what's happening with Xi Jinping and the threat of a totalitarian government there that is more, you know, more sort of oppressive than it is right now in terms of information. And if they're already turning to the blockchain, that I think that's a plus.
It's interesting. Like, I was like, well, okay, so what is the analog equivalent of this? Like, what is the pre-digital equivalent? And I think it's the book. The book is the immutable artifact. Yeah, like, books have been lost to history, but, you know, that's like, outside of a 1984 type history, that's what books are. If you publish a book, the contents of that book are generally written into history, particularly in the 20th century. Very hard to make a book totally disappear from the public consciousness. And I think we've been able to navigate that pretty effectively. Like, the fact that Mein Kampf still exists and has not been purged from the world, I think is a good thing. I think it's worthwhile to allow for a class of information that's immutable.
I agree with you. And I think that it needs to be efficient in a way where people, given the speed with which they need information now, can access it. And I would say that of all the stories that I read this week about Bitcoin, blockchain, this one was the most exciting to me because it seemed to be the type of thing, A, that a lot of people can rally around. You know, it's not about like some sort of abstract idea and it's not about money. It is really about something that I think a lot of people would agree is a good thing, which is to sort of fight censorship in countries like China.
I guess if China is able to censor internet sites and HTTP requests, what stops them from just blocking the Ethereum blockchain from China wholesale to prevent this kind of stuff from being disseminated?
Can they actually do that?
I don't know. That's a really interesting question. Like, how would someone go about blocking the blockchain?
I don't know. It's a question for somebody else.
Okay, we'll have to ask someone that on the show. I think that if this becomes prevalent enough, this will become an issue. Like, in all of the things that we think about, decentralized applications and blockchain becoming a new form of internet, like or a replacement for the internet, there was a time when the internet itself was uncensorable until people figured out how to censor it.
But that's what is the most exciting part about this for me. I remember what I was excited about, which is that it's like, in terms of the new internet, right? Which is a phrase that's thrown out all the time and it sounds ridiculous.
Yep.
But this is really the first thing where I was like, oh, maybe it really is the new internet in some sort of way, because AWS can't shut this down, you know? A lot of people already have this in a way where it can't be taken off, you know? I guess it could be taken off if more than 50% of the people decide, made some sort of decision or something like that, but that's certainly not going to happen. And it seems like a different way to sort of store information in a era in which we have highly centralized powers that do control the internet and do control information. It's just a different path, and it'll get more efficient, it'll get more elegant, it'll be easier to access, and then at that point, I feel like you might have an actual new internet.
Yeah, I mean, we've made jokes on this show about, like, trying to store information in the notes field of Ethereum blockchain, that's, like, real user-friendly, but there's no reason someone can't build user-friendly interfaces for some of this stuff and really create a new internet that does allow you to navigate some of these decentralized spaces effectively. We're just in an incredibly nascent state.
Yeah,
right,
like,
now.
Do you, I mean, Aaron, you and I are about the same age and about the same level of nerdiness, but, like, do you remember how hard it was to play MUDs back in the day?
Oh, my God. Yes.
It was horrible. You had to, like,
Did you used to call bulletin board services when you were younger?
Yeah, of course. So you had to, like, we had to queue up our modems.
Yeah.
We had to memorize these lines of text and then this complete, I don't think I could decipher it right now. And these, like, completely indecipherable, like, lines of text would come up and then you train your brain to figure it out. Like, that was not that long ago. You, like, that was probably what, like, when you and I were like 15 or 16 years old. So it was like 22 years ago.
I feel like that was more like when we were like 12, maybe.
Well, I'm a couple years older.
You're a couple years ahead of me. Yeah. And I remember how much you had to learn about the systems you were using before you could do anything on them.
Yeah, you had to learn the like why the modem worked.
The MS-DOS prompts, you know? Yeah. Like, just to play a game, you kind of had to know, like, the entire DOS language. And I think that was valuable. And I think that the something that's exciting to me about decentralized crypto projects is they're not that easy. And if people do get involved in them, teenagers, 12-year-olds or whatever, they're going to know way more than you and I do. And while they're learning how to use them, they are going to be creating the future of them in the way that, like, we learned how to use the internet and that became the internet. The kinds of things we were learning about on bulletin boards and AOL chat rooms, that influenced what Twitter and Facebook became.
This is exactly the type of thing that fueled the original internet. It's not like a mainstream thing like a dApp that allows you to have Facebook decentralized. Yep. It is a specific concern that excites a lot of people because it seems to be solving a problem that everyone is dealing with.
Speaking of the early internet, one of the things I was curious to get your take on was a lot of stuff has come out in the last couple of weeks about this consortium of venture capitalists who have been creating a working group and trying to lobby for a safe harbor exemption for certain tokens to not be treated as securities and basically not be subject to the same regulations that securities are generally subject to. And it's an interesting like echo of that early internet, because I think the guiding ethos, at least from Silicon Valley and venture capitalists, had been like, don't regulate. Let us figure it out. You're going to kill whatever innovation or potential billion-dollar, trillion-dollar industry by over-regulating it. We know best. Let us do it. And so it makes sense to me that now that crypto is becoming a big part of what investors are interested in, they would feel the same way about, you know, avoiding regulations for cryptos. This is a strange time to be making that argument, though, with Mark Zuckerberg testifying before Congress and the biggest products of that Silicon Valley era finally facing some regulatory scrutiny.
And like a breaking point with the public.
And, a break in public trust.
Yeah, yeah. It is a hard time for them to be making this argument right now.
A year ago would have been a better time for the Safe Harbor Act, I feel like.
Tell me a little bit about it, because like I'm not quite clear on it, but it's... They see an inevitability, right? They think that the SEC is going to be heavy-handed and call all these things securities. And
I don't know about all of them, but a lot of them. Yeah. Particularly ICOs. So a worst-case scenario here, and there's an interview in the New York Times with, I think it's Neil Gensler, who was formerly of the CFTC, where he was like, all right, I'll just name two. Two things that look a lot like securities to me are Ripple and Ethereum. And if Ethereum's a security, all of the ICOs that have been done on top of Ethereum are potentially securities also. That would be a major, major shift. That would sort of end the ICO market. It would end a lot of the functionality of Ethereum.
Wait, but why? Why would it end the...
Well, it would mean that only certain types of investors would be able to invest.
You would have to be an accredited investor, so you'd either have to have over $1 million in net worth or $200,000 a year or something like that, right? Like, isn't that what
I think? I don't know that that's the exact, like,
it's somewhere around there.
Something around there. And additionally, there is a huge amount of work involved in complying with being a security that none of these companies have been doing, none of them want to do, and might severely limit their potential.
Yeah.
When we've talked about the Bitcoin apocalypse scenario, this is a little bit of the ICO Ethereum apocalypse scenario. I don't think it's likely, but I think when you're like, how would Ethereum just go down in like a giant Hindenburg crash? This is one way it could.
I don't understand how they are going to have that much traction, honestly. It seems like the SEC is going to do what the SEC wants to do. I read a bit about this. I don't find the arguments that Ethereum is not a security, but other things are securities, I just don't find that particularly convincing.
Well, there's two good articles I'd recommend. For the Ethereum is not a security argument, check out our former guest, the Coin Center's Peter Van Valkenburg. He wrote about that. And I think Preston Byrne had something pretty good that took the other side of that issue. And I think the like central sticking point, there's something called the Howey test. That's supposedly how you test if something is a security or not. And I think the biggest variable in how we would evaluate something like Ethereum is its decentralized nature. If you believe that Ethereum is a totally decentralized application that's not owned or controlled by anyone, then it's probably not a security.
If Wait, you but said, why? Why?
For something to be a security, I believe it has to be issued by someone.
Sure.
And a decentralized, like Bitcoin was not issued by anyone. Bitcoin is mined, but no one's ever issued someone a Bitcoin token. So what it comes down to for Ethereum, I think, if I read this correctly, it comes down to this Ethereum presale. Is that the Ethereum Foundation distributing Ethereum, or is that a totally decentralized event like the Genesis block of Bitcoin? One of the arguments that Van Valkenburg is making, which I think is kind of interesting, is that Ethereum had two periods. It had the presale period and the current period. And he draws a bunch of distinctions between these periods. Like in the presale period, the records were kept in a centralized database for the Ethereum Foundation. In the post presale period, they are now held in a decentralized blockchain. So I think he's basically saying that, like, yes, the original sale would have been a security, but it's become something different now, and that's not a security.
Wow, he's like using the Shaggy defense.
Like, well, that wasn't me.
Yeah, it wasn't me. Like, he's basically saying that the thing that issued the token and kept records in a centralized place and had an entire foundation, like, that's not actually Ethereum anymore. All that is another thing that just had the same name. And at this point, what is Ethereum has sort of changed, not even that it's different, but that it has sort of had this metaphysical and full body change, and now it is something different. Like, it is, like, it's morphed. It's now a different thing.
I kind of buy it. I mean, insofar as something can start off centralized and become decentralized, it's not the same thing forever. This centrally comes down to, like, does Ethereum require any central authority to continue? If the Ethereum Foundation ends, will Ethereum end?
Probably.
But not necessarily. What's stopping it from... I mean, the GitHub page will get real quiet, but maybe there won't be future development on it. But I think it would continue to work and be used.
Yeah, well, I read Preston Burns' response. I enjoy his writing, even when I disagree with it, because I think he makes points very clearly. One of the things he said was that the way that Howey works, the way that U.S. security law works, is that you kind of have to get under the hood and figure out what is actually going on, right? So you can't take a 10,000-foot bird's-eye view and look down on it and say, well, that kind of looks like a security, and that doesn't really look like a security. And so in that sense, I would say that we don't really know, because we don't know how decentralized Ethereum is right now. We don't know who holds a ton of Ethereum. We don't know how influence really works, right? Like, we have a general sense. We know what Vitalik says. We know what Peter Van Valkenburg says, but we ultimately don't know.
We know that it's more decentralized than it was because people are mining it and more people are holding it, but we don't know how decentralized it is.
Yes. And I would say that, and I think that this is what Preston Byrne is arguing in some ways as well, which is that even if it has become more decentralized, you cannot say that it has had a full body conversion and that it is now something completely different, that they did have a presale.
Yep.
A lot of those tokens did go to small numbers of people, right? Yep. A lot of those people are now very wealthy and very invested in the future of Ethereum.
And a lot of those people have ties to the Ethereum Foundation.
Exactly. So if you're trying to say that there's no longer a central force that's very powerful in it, there's no sort of centralized group that benefits from Ethereum going up or down or the future of Ethereum or people investing more in Ethereum, I think that that probably fails, you know? And at that point, yeah, I would argue that I think that if the Securities Commission was to say that Ethereum is not a security, right, then I think that it would be very hard for them to argue that anything is a security.
I kind of agree with you. And all of the arguments we've just made about Ethereum are like times 7 if you take Ripple.
Yeah, maybe times 100.
Times 100, yeah. Like, There's good arguments on both sides with Ethereum. I'd say there's not very many good arguments that Ripple's not a security in my mind. It seems to be very heavily controlled by a central corporation.
Is Ripple part of this exemption?
Well, one thing that they do have going for them is they've got Snoop Dogg playing at their consensus event. So that's actually gets you a special exemption.
I feel like that's proof of centralization. Right? Like Snoop Dogg only really plays at things that are like centralized corporate events now. The last thing I'll say about this is that, or the last question I'll ask you is, do you think that the argument that this thing is completely decentralized and that therefore should not be treated as a security, do you think that that argument is hampered by the fact that they have Vitalik Buterin as a centerpiece of all this?
I do. I think the most notable difference between Bitcoin Core and the Ethereum Foundation is the lack of a figurehead in Bitcoin. And I think that's a very smart decision by whoever Satoshi Nakamoto is. And I think it puts it in this realm where you can truly say the person who made this is anonymous. This could continue for hundreds of years without intervention. And this is not the product of a company or a corporation or some issuance. Do you think that if Ethereum had it over again, they would not do the pre-sale?
Oh, yeah. Well, because, I mean, if they knew that they were going to be this successful,
right,
you know, like, they certainly wouldn't have. I don't think so.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of how, like, before Vitalik started Ethereum, he was, like, involved in, like, some kind of scammy stuff, supposedly. And it's like, I'm sure he wishes he hadn't been involved in that before he was involved in Ethereum. You get involved in some, you know, more questionable stuff when you're starting off. You really need the money for to get your idea off the ground. What if Ethereum had just been a truly mindable project from day one? There was never any pre-sale. Then again, maybe they would have never gotten here then.
No, and I don't think they would have. And that is the same thing with Vitalik, right?
Yep.
Like, if you don't have Vitalik as the talking head who goes on YouTube or whatever and talks about this thing, if you don't have the belief in the central figure that you write magazine profiles of, who, you know, is quite identifiably a genius.
Yeah.
You know, like, I don't think it gets off the ground at all. So, you know, you have a double-edged sword here, and I think that at some point they're probably just going to have to be like, look, we can make all these arguments we want, but at some point the SEC is going to come and look under the hood, and they're going to also use sort of a smell test, and then we probably will fail that.
Right.
Speaking of centralization and securities and all these things, it's been a while since we've done this, but I think that we should talk about a specific coin.
Yeah, I think so too, especially with, there was a fake-out alt season this week. Alt season kicked in hard and then like immediately like pulled the brakes and jumped back. But I was certainly like scanning my list being like, huh, what is that again? Like, and I think this is also actually an interesting conversation to be had about, like, we were just discussing Vitalik as the central figure in Ethereum. Coinbase has Brian Armstrong as their central figure. And I think the coin I want to talk about is 0x. That's what it's called, right?
Yeah,
ZRX? No,
yeah.
Okay. Yeah, ZRX. And one of the reasons that ZRX has been like at the top of my Blockfolio watch list is a lot of rumors that Coinbase is going to add ZRX next.
Yeah, yeah. So let's just be very clear.
Yeah.
The only reason why we are talking about ZRX and the only reason why it has been so in the news a lot, and the reason why its profile has sort of gone up from only being on Binance and a thing that I owned a shitload of at some point, and then exited.
I've never made any 0x money because I don't have a Binance account. I don't think it's on Bittrex, or it wasn't.
Man, I mean, as you know, because we talked about this a lot, I had a lot of it and exited at an okay time before the crash. But, you know, but that has not, my investment in it has absolutely nothing to do with
absolutely
me believing in it. It was just because, like, some guy we know told me to buy it.
Yeah.
but it, you know, I did do some research into it, but now it is back, right?
Yeah.
It is, I would say, I don't think that it's even controversial to say, I think it is the most discussed altcoin in terms of people who are speculating. I mean, I get texts about it from my friends more than any other coin. And it is all because of this rumor out there that it is going to be added to Coinbase. So I think that we should look at least at some of its properties in the context of it being added to Coinbase. Like, if this is true, right?
Yeah.
Why this coin?
Okay, well, let's look back at the history. So Coinbase announced that they would be starting to support ERC-20 tokens, Ethereum tokens. Not totally clear whether that means just custodial, you can store your ERC-20 tokens here, or you'll eventually be able to trade your ERC-20 tokens. Either way, great, great day for the ERC-20 community and market cap. And instantly, you have to go, well, which ones? Yeah. You know, like, what's the first one? Because that, like, everything we've seen about the psychology of noobs says, like, anything near Coinbase or GDAX is going to get, like, a lot of attention right out of the gate. And the three coins that I've heard rumors about are Basic Attention Token, BAT, Augur, REP, and 0x, ZRX. And all three of those rumors, so far as I know, originate from Brian Armstrong's Twitter account.
Mm-hmm.
So I think someone tweeted, 0x has done more for Ethereum than all of the ICOs combined.
How?
It was not my tweet.
Okay.
And then he like very quickly like un-retweeted it. So that's basically like the
that's
entire
where this rumor came from? Like,
yeah, this entire segment.
He could have fat fingered it.
This entire thing is from that. But he could have fat fingered it, but it makes sense also,
yes,
which is why
sense.
It's a good rumor. So right off the bat, we both independently did a little 0x research.
Yeah, yeah. And I think to give some context, we have to give some context about Brian Armstrong, who we've talked about quite a bit on this show.
Yes.
Which is that from what we know about him, because and from the small things in which he's public about, for example, his Toshi app, which he put out, which you and I have discussed at length. Brian Armstrong is an Ethereum maximalist. Like, he believes that the future of Silicon Valley in some way will be rooted through Ethereum
future
technology.
Future of Silicon Valley, the future of humanity.
Future of humanity, the future of, like, basically the complex systems and the ecosystems in which human beings relate to one another, like, trade money and build societies will be based on Ethereum. Like, I don't think that's a stretch to say.
Yes, and the system he imagines that is referred to as dApps, which are interlocking applications and tokens that power all sorts of peer-to-peer marketplaces and charity and rote labor.
He has a full vision of it.
Yes.
World is on the Ethereum blockchain. And so it would make sense that in his company, that the things that he would want to promote would be things that help along that economy. And all three of those things, right? Augur, which is a prediction market,
Basic Attention Token, which is how you get paid out by the Brave browser for your browsings.
Yes,
for content creators.
And 0x, which is a platform in which you can generate other types of platforms. It's sort of like a platform upon which to build other platforms and to also build dApps.
Yep.
All three of those help Brian Armstrong's world. And so they're all consistent with this vision that we're
They're
having.
All very different takes on like what an eth maximalist worldview could be. In some ways, 0x is the most neutral take because it's like Ethereum on top of Ethereum.
Yeah.
But the other two are like practical real world applications of what could be the first viable dApp for mass consumption.
Okay, so with 0x, what does it actually do?
First thing I noticed when I started looking into it, 0x does not have a Wikipedia page.
That's very suspicious.
To me, this is like, it's like a big thing that's happening in the world, but it's not even meriting. I could be totally wrong.
I mean, I have a Wikipedia page.
It's going to be really embarrassing when people all send me the 0x Wikipedia page. But it speaks to the circularity and repetition of information online about this stuff, where I like, first I Googled 0x and I was like, huh, not a Wikipedia page. That's weird. And then I was like, why do people think Coinbase is adding ZRX? And it was just a Reddit thread about that Brian Armstrong tweet. And most of the information about why people think it's going to be on Coinbase are either from that tweet or people being like, many people are talking about this.
Yes.
Not a ton of information out there. And in terms of considering how ZRX actually works, it's an open, permissionless protocol allowing for ERC-20s to be traded on the Ethereum blockchain. And the research I did would put a bold on the word frictionless.
Yep.
A big part of the promise of 0x is that these dApps are going to be able to be moving all kinds of ERC-20 tokens and making all kinds of smart contracts, and none of it is going to cost or burn anything. It will be a perpetual motion machine of dApps controlling your whole life.
Yes.
If you were to ask me, well, why do you need that on top of Ethereum to power these dApps? It seems like the upside of ZRX is that it does some of these things that Ethereum does, but without any friction, without burning anything along the way.
Well, it does it by exporting a lot of the stuff that does not need to be on the blockchain out of the blockchain. And so it uses less gas, right? It uses less space. It requires less energy if you use it. So it is essentially just like an engine in which all of this can run at a much, much more efficient pace.
Yeah. And I feel like as non-technical eth developers, we can't really gauge how important that is or how valuable that would be. When I look at it compared to BAT and wrap, I'm like, of these three things, two of them people can wrap their head around how they work, use them. And one of them is kind of like bringing more Ethereum to the Ethereum party.
Yeah, it's you need a second level of knowledge to understand why it's necessary. Yeah.
So to me, it seems less likely that it would get added to Coinbase, except as infrastructure to add more stuff to Coinbase in the future. One thing I don't totally get about ZRX is like when you build projects on top of the Ethereum blockchain, they use ERC-20 tokens. Like, are tokens of things that use ZRX like ZRX-20? Tokens, or are they just a subset of ERC-20 tokens?
No, I mean, you can print your own, but the this again is the sort of endless dilemma about these tokens and these ERC-20 projects that print their own token, which is just like, it's hard to find a use case for these tokens except for using to buy, like, the ability, you know, to use to pay to use the service, you know? And at that point, you're just like, well, why don't I just give you Ethereum? Why don't I just give you Bitcoin? Why don't I just give you my credit card number?
Well, we've thought of two pretty good use cases, which are basic attention token and
Augur. No. I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about 0x.
Yeah, but I'm saying that if we can think of these use cases for Ethereum, we can think of use cases for an even more efficient and frictionless blend of Ethereum. And it makes sense to me that there would be like additional layers here. Like if we're going to create a piping system to run the entire economy through smart contracts, it's going to take more than like vanilla Ethereum to do so. But the other thing that really caught my eye when I was going through it is this is a real Silicon Valley project. Like if you look at the people who are working on it, it's people who are ex-Google, ex-Apple. It has a real startup flavor that's very identifiable.
What we do know is that, again, we are way in Brian Armstrong's head.
Yeah.
But like, and it might not be true. The two things that these things have in common is A, what we already talked about, that they are sort of helpers of the Ethereum world that he wants to build. And secondly, they are people who most likely live down the street from him or work down the street from him, and that they have been rubber stamped by places that they used to work, the places where they studied computer science. It is not a shady project with a shady team. It is people who have their photos on the website. It is people who you can look up everything that they've done in the past. And, you know, just from looking at that, you know, diving a little bit into what they've done, you can have a reasonable trust that these people are probably working on something real and that they're not just like sort of sitting around in a room and like looking at a Binance chart and be like, all right, we're a little bit richer. Let's go home. And I think that's very, very important for whatever is next on Coinbase, because with the amount of scrutiny that is around Coinbase and around the crypto world in general, it would be catastrophic for Coinbase, I think, to link up with something that was a little bit shadier, you know, and not even shadier, because it could be that, you know, like something like Waves that's in Russia is just as legitimate, but it's harder for us to verify from here.
I'm pretty sure Waves is not as legitimate. I'm comfortable down that line.
You would not say that if Doug Kim in the Waves.
Well, here's why, because Waves is like housed in a country controlled by Vladimir Putin. I do think that there is a national character to these projects, and especially if you're issuing tokens on top of the project. I would not issue a token that was on a Russian blockchain right now.
And it is much easier for the SEC, for example, to sort of investigate 0x and say, okay, if you're going to be part of this, then this exchange is not dealing with something that might be fraudulent.
I do think like it strategically makes sense for Brian Armstrong and Coinbase to take their company this direction, because if you win, it's a bigger win. It's like a bigger pot. If smart contracts take over the world, I think that is more profound than simply taking over money, which is Bitcoin.
Yeah.
It's also a bigger risk and a bigger gamble. While I think that Bitcoin has been validated as something that people want and want to use, ERC-20 tokens have not really been totally validated under that hypothesis. But this is how a Silicon Valley mindset operates. It's always make the bigger bet. Do not take the 10X. Yeah. Go for the 1,000X. It doesn't matter if you're risking the 10X. And it's
this
just...
This is Brian Armstrong's "Do You Know What's Cooler Than $1 Million" moment.
Pretty much. I mean, like, I think he's... I don't think it's... I think his that moment was like 2 years ago for him. I think you look at Bitcoin, you almost have like two strands in the family tree of crypto, which is this one strand that starts with the dark web and starts with people who want to do semi-anonymous, shady online transactions, and they accidentally create an entire decentralized world. Not accidentally, intentionally create an entire decentralized currency around it. And then there's this other strand of people who want smart contracts to power everything about your life and everything about your banking and identity and everything else. And I almost don't, like, I don't see those two paths ever crossing over each other again. The only war they're really at with each other is for market share, right? Do you feel like the Bitcoin and Ethereum worldviews even really matter much to each other at this point?
No, actually, you know, that's good, because that's actually the last thing I want to talk about on this topic, which is that, you know, from a zoomed out perspective,
yep,
it really does seem like they've been more divergent in the past few weeks or in the past few months, you know, that you do have stories about Ethereum that do seem to be closer to being able to articulate a world in which Ethereum is a big deal and that it replaces a lot of the functions in which we use on our phone or on the internet, and that it affects large portions of our life, and that they seem to not really even be interested in talking about Bitcoin.
Yep.
And whereas Bitcoin seems to be sort of going another path, which is actually somewhat closer to the origins of Bitcoin, right? Which is we are looking at a world in which a deflationary currency is a good idea. And that's what we're concerned about. So, like, nobody in the Bitcoin community is saying, like, let's build Bitcoin apps, like B apps, and, you know, figure out ways in which we can, like, create a better version of Twitter or something like that. And I don't know if it's for any other reason than I feel like the people who are behind Ethereum projects have recently been able to articulate their ideas a little bit better.
And that makes sense. Like, it makes sense that the V1 is different from the V3 and that people have to experiment and pivot. I think we make fun of some of the ideals of Silicon Valley, but these are people who are experienced at building giant ideas that seem silly at first.
Or might be horrible for the world.
Or might destroy the world. It seems like Bitcoin is more comfortable with Bitcoin being the whole idea. I don't think Bitcoin necessarily needs to, like, change what it's doing a lot in the next few years in order to validate its importance and its hypothesis. And I think that's, like, made me a bit more of a Bitcoin maximalist recently, which is just like, I get what I'm support. When I support Bitcoin, I think I've wrapped my head around at least like 50% of it. I don't really understand a lot of this Ethereum world stuff. And maybe Brian Armstrong understands it better than I do, and he's seeing a future that I can't see.
He probably does.
He probably does.
But his extrapolation or his conclusions might be worse.
Well, I do think that those people need to get better at articulating the world that they're imagining. It can't simply be like more tokens, more like more Ethereum, more everything. Like, there has to be like a pause where we start actually showing people like what to do with this stuff.
But what if they're in the mud phase right now, which I think that's what they would argue, right?
Yeah.
Like what we talked about early in the podcast. Like, it's very hard to articulate and extrapolate out of what we have right now what it's going to be, but that clearly it's going to be something.
I agree with that. I think we are in that mud phase. It's weird to talk about the joint, like, Ethereum Bitcoin market cap as a result of that, because I don't understand why, if Ethereum moves past its mud phase, that's a bad thing for Bitcoin, or Bitcoin should be like, oh, we're in decline. In some ways, I always think that Bitcoin will be the gateway drug to all of this stuff, because it's like much easier to understand at the gateway, at least, like what you're doing. And I expect that over time, like if Ethereum is right, if the Ethereum world is right, then over time it will become bigger than Bitcoin, I think.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And it does seem, you know, in the last 6 months at least, or 3 months even, that there has been more divergence than there was in the past year and a half, if that makes sense. Like, the two were always compared to one another. The question you and I always get is, should I buy Bitcoin or should I buy Ethereum? And I think what Ethereum wants, maybe what Bitcoin wants as well, but what the people who are backing Ethereum really want is for that question to end. You know, like, they don't want to be involved with Bitcoin at all.
And I think that it's proper to think of Ethereum and 0x more in terms of startups. I think that they're like startups that have a certain amount of runway, and they have to make a strong case during that runway that people should invest more in them and that their vision is going to take over the world, or it's going to like fall apart. Whereas Bitcoin, I think the vision has already been executed, and we can start thinking about Bitcoin as a store of value, as something that has like a long-term place to park money and wealth. And if Bitcoin is basically exactly the same thing, but a little bit more efficient and has figured out some lightning network stuff in the next couple of years, I don't feel like Bitcoin will be like behind as a result. I think Bitcoin is in somewhat of a more stable position, despite the price not being stable, because the idea is stable.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I still don't want to live in Brian Armstrong's world.
You wouldn't want to live in anyone's world.
I mean, I'm okay living in this current world. Cool. Is there anything else you want to talk about?
Oh, hey, I got something for you. You'll see here, this lovely book here I've purchased, The Bitcoin Standard, by Saifedean Ammous. Do you know how to say his name?
Famous eater of only meat. I think he's a carnivore.
Carnivore. I'm going to start this book. I was wondering if you would like to read it alongside me, and we could start a little podcast book club.
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, look, the books that I tend to read these days are really not going to be that much better.
I mean, I've heard this book getting a lot of praise. So if you're interested, let's say we'll do it in quarters.
Yeah.
So we'll do it over 4 weeks. We won't start this week because we'll give you time to go buy the book.
Mm-hmm. Do I have to buy it with Bitcoin?
No, you can get the Kindle one. I'll tell you, the printing is very cheap. So I don't even know if I totally endorse getting the print copy, but pick it up in the Kindle. It's only a few bucks. Read alongside us. We'll announce next show what the page numbers we're going to go up to are. And I think it'll be nice to, sometimes I feel like we're like butting up against the limits of like how we can discuss this stuff based on a like 200 word CoinDesk article.
Yep.
And hopefully the book will provide a framework for us to get a little deeper, and people who are reading along can send in questions. We will answer them. Maybe we'll have a guest or two who's read the book on. It'll be fun.
Yep.
All right, cool. See you next week.
All right.
This episode of Coin Talk was taped Wednesday, April 18th at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The Bitcoin price index was $8,111.
That was Coin Talk, edited this week by James Nicholson. Thanks very much to my co-host, Jay Kang. Thanks to our partners at Medium. You can find every episode of the show, including transcripts, at medium.com/cointalk. It's a kind of a fast way to get through the archives if you like to read this kind of thing. Also, you can send us an email, hi@cointalk.show. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week.